she's their worst nightmare. She's probably worse than Hillary, though they might not have the kind of instinctive animus that they did for her. But I also think it's their worst nightmare in terms of the people in the new right who are smart probably understand that this is really a big challenge and a liability, and that the stuff is so racist and so misogynist, the whole movement kind of is, that it's going to be hard to rein that in. Mm. And they probably need to if they want to win. The funny thing about Kamala is she's not miserable. She's a very happy person. She's not a miserable cat lady. So
which they also hate, yeah.
They hate it. And they cannot sort of wrap their heads around women having power. Yeah. So it's very tricky for them. I think they're in a real bind.
I'm Jon Favreau. Welcome to Offline. Hey, everyone. You just heard from today's guest, writer and political theorist Laura Field. So you may have noticed something new about the 2024 campaign recently, and I'm not talking about the Democratic nominee. Over the last few weeks, lots of Democrats, from Kamala Harris down to the shit posters, have started calling Republicans out for being really fucking weird. And let's be honest, the party is not beating the allegations. From J.D. Vance's war on childless cat ladies to libs of TikTok's obsession with trans kids to Trump's insistence that Kamala Harris actually isn't black, the Republican Party's priorities have felt increasingly out of line with the views of the vast majority of Americans. But when did they get this weird and extreme? Where did all these ideas come from? Laura Field is a researcher and political theorist who has spent her career studying reactionary conservatism and the, quote, new right. She recently published a piece in Politico titled, J.D. Vance Has a Bunch of Weird Views on Gender, and she's working on a new book about the evolution of the Republican Party titled Untethered, New Right Intellectualism and the Future of American Conservatism. I invited her on to talk about how GOP weirdness can be explained by the emergence of the new right, how J.D. Vance exemplifies this moment, and why Democrats calling out these views may be the most effective ways of preventing this movement from capturing more power in American politics. As a heads up, we're getting straight into the interview this week. Laura and I had lots to talk about. J.D. Vance, Project 2025, Donald Trump, all kinds of stuff. Here's Laura Field. Laura Field, welcome to Offline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you wrote a piece in Politico magazine last week that caught my eye about J.D. Vance, his pretty out there views on gender, and the intellectual mm-hmm. wing of the MAGA movement known as the New Right, which you're currently writing a book about. And I wanted to talk to you about this because there's been a lot of focus on Vance's childless cat lady comments, his views on abortion, and him just being weird. But I think it's important for people to understand that there is a political philosophy behind all of this, a pretty extreme political philosophy, that mm-hmm. will likely be with us long after Trump leaves the scene, and probably started even a little before he entered the scene. Mm-hmm. But just to start, what led you to become something of an expert on the new right?
Well, it's a good question. I studied political philosophy as an undergraduate, and then I did an MA in it, and I kind of got caught up in a certain corner of the conservative intellectual world. So I did a PhD in political philosophy, and I've never been a conservative, but I've sort of studied with conservatives through that whole education. And then when I saw in 2016 the sort of some of these people who I knew get involved in defending Trump and sort of some of the first people to get on board with Trumpism and to try to sort of build out this intellectual architecture for Trump, that was sort of shocking to me because they weren't good friends of mine or anything, but they were sort of very in very close worlds to my world. And so I was shocked by that, and I got interested in learning more, and then I just started writing about it because I sort of understood where they were coming from. I've learned a lot about the conservative intellectual tradition since then. You know, I wasn't really an expert in conservative history. I was pretty into the great books, you know, like my dissertation was on Rousseau and Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. So this was not my main area of interest, but then I kind of got caught up in political events myself and decided I wanted to write about it because I think I do have a particular perspective on this, having been sort of adjacent to those worlds for so long.
Well, maybe that's a good place to start, is the people that you knew in conservative intellectual circles. What was sort of the philosophical transformation from what they had previously believed to trying to sort of retcon that to what Donald Trump believed, or at least manifesting itself in support of Donald Trump?
So I think that there are all these different little worlds, right, that we're talking about. And so the particular one that I came from is sort of one corner of one part of it. And they are not I'd say they're conservatives and more like the old fusionist conservatism, right, where they believe in liberal economics, they're socially conservative, but still sort of have an internationalist bent. So that's sort of the old conservatism that I would be familiar with. Some of these other pockets, like the West Coast Straussians and some of the people who got behind Trump earliest, I think they have always had sort of a radical streak where they're really, they believe in sort of the American founding in a very sort of dogmatic way. They sort of think that this compromise fusionism that we see, sort of the old establishment conservatism, was always kind of a half-baked compromise that doesn't make much sense and was not truly conservative. So they have a much more reactionary streak in what they believe. They're sort of reaching back into these older traditions that we could call the old right, which is much more isolationist, is much more committed to economic nationalism, right? And as anti-immigration, but is still socially conservative. So they've got this sort of, this is an old tradition that's sort of, that we could call it the old right that we sometimes talk about, is this sort of early part of the 20th century conservatism. That's been a force in American conservatism all through the 20th century, and you can sort of see it flare up again and again. In the 90s, there was quite a bit of this, and then there's this a group called the paleoconservatives. And so you see it sort of, these sort of weird forces burgeoning up throughout history. And then, but these guys have sort of always been connected to some of that. And so Trump, they saw as a real opportunity to bring some of this back to a much sort of more old-fashioned kind of conservatism. And I think really the social conservatism is the kind of the most important thing for them. It's this effort to really sort of restore America to what they understood it to be in the 50s or even earlier.
Yeah, I'm so interested in it because I do think, you know, if you ask a lot of political liberals or Democrats sort of to explain Trump in 2016, they say, okay, well, there's a lot of people who they are okay with or believe in his sort of racism and misogyny. And, you know, it's about him trying to make people afraid of others, people who don't look like them or come from where they do.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that. And is there really a philosophy behind it? And I think that your writing suggests that there is more of an actual like political belief behind it, which is, you know, Republicans like all through my lifetime have been, like you said, free market conservatives, very into tax cuts, deregulation, internationalist, a muscular internationalism, and then of course the social conservatism, but perhaps not quite as extreme as the new right. And, you know, up until Donald Trump, pretty willing to be more open on immigration and immigration reform, even though they were, you know, cared a lot about securing borders. How would you describe sort of like the philosophy of the new right as it exists today?
So I'm just going to start by saying a little bit about how the establishment understood conservatism, which is to say, since Reagan, you have a fusionist vision where there's liberal economics, social conservatism, and liberal internationalism sort of all fused together. And anti-communism is a big part of that, right? And the new right sort of has rejected that compromise. They reject the liberal economics, sort of the globalist economics, and they want nationalist economics. And so that's, you saw that with Trump with the trade wars. They want closed borders, right? They talk about secure, you know, a secure anti-immigration position. And then they talk about like an American first foreign policy, right? So that's kind of more isolationist, maybe more skeptical about America's role in the world. And then, but they really have gone very hard on the social conservatism. And I think overall what we see here is an effort to really preserve a homogenous America, right? A one nation nationalist perspective. And so that's what they're really seeking is they're rejecting liberalism, right? And partly they're doing this because they are anti-progressive, anti-liberal. They hate a lot of the changes that have happened over the last couple decades especially. But they think things have gotten so bad right now, and this is where we get some of the real radicalism coming in, that they reject sort of the basic liberal democratic order. And so some of the most radical people on the new right, they think things have gotten so extreme that anything goes, right? This is where you get sort of the rhetoric around January 6th and stuff. That you really have to take extreme measures to try to turn back the clock.
Can you talk a little bit about Michael Anton and the Flight 93 election for people who aren't familiar with that? Because I do think he, in that essay and since then, has really sort of summed up the worldview.
Michael Anton is a complicated guy with a very interesting background, but he wrote this essay called The Flight 93 Election in 2016. And he had been defending Trump already online for months, right? He was really early on the sort of the Trump bandwagon. And I think he saw that Trump represented something really interesting and a real opportunity for this sort of old-fashioned kind of conservatism. So he wrote this essay, which was a really shocking and offensive essay, I think, called The Flight 93 Election, where the premise of it was that if Hillary Clinton were to win, it would be the end of America. It would sort of be like the final nail in the coffin. The analogy is to the Flight 93 from 9/11, right?
Right, and basically the idea was that the Democrats are the terrorists in the cockpit.
Yeah, the Democrats are the terrorists. If you vote for Hillary, you're going to crash the plane. It was kind of all hands on deck to stop that from happening. And electing Trump is like being the hero that takes down the plane. So pretty offensive, right? Comparing Democrats to terrorists. But that's how this guy thinks, right? He talks about if Hillary Clinton wins, it's like playing Russian roulette with a semi-automatic weapon, right? I mean, it's really sort of violent imagery. And the essay was aimed especially at the establishment Republicans. It was a real kind of grievance-mongering piece about how much the establishment conservatism had conceded to the left and how basically conservatism hadn't won anything. Conservatism had sort of been rolling over for liberals for, 40 years. And so that it was really time to just take back control, close the borders, really offensive stuff in there about Muslims and, I mean, just everything you can imagine. And so this essay got published in the Claremont Review of Books, which was a pretty mainstream publication put out by the Claremont Institute. So it's pretty shocking to a lot of people that they published that. And then it got read on the Rush Limbaugh show in early September 2016 and sort of went viral after that. I'm not saying it had any impact on the election, but it was sort of the first real sense that there is some intellectual heft. I mean, it's tricky, right? Because Anton is not like a brilliant genius. Some other people in the new right who have since come along and joined the movement are, I think, much more respectable than Anton.
Well, no, I think it's important that the way that you're talking about this and write about this because, you look at Trump and Trumpism and a lot of people say, understandably, cult of personality, there is no ideology behind Trump and it's just sort of, random racism and xenophobia and it's all about Trump. But it does seem like this economic, close the borders, stop trade, isolationist, and then extreme cultural conservatism, and we can talk about it, but from some of these new right thinkers is like going back to an explicit hierarchy of race, ethnicity, and gender in this country. Yeah. that goes further than just, you know, your old school social conservatives and what they believed about that. It seems more explicit.
Yeah, it's much more explicit. And I think that's right. And an important, I think what I would want to say to your audience, because I do, I mean, my good friends are liberals, and but there's a general misunderstanding, I think, of the intellectual strength of some of this and the radicalism of it and the, and sort of the depth of it. And so a lot of these guys, especially on the new right, I am not talking about ordinary Republicans, right? I think that some of them are certainly sort of red-pilled or whatever. But a lot of these guys are ideologues, right? It's not, this is not about the grift, right? It's not necessarily about sort of making money or getting famous, though I'm sure that there are mixed motives, obviously, for all these different people. But these are people, a lot of whom are really self-convinced that there is a crisis, right, in this country, that progressivism is terrible for everybody, including, you know, everybody who calls himself a progressive or a liberal. And so they think they're sort of saving the world. They're on sort of a world historical mission. There's a real, and it's intellectual, right? It's sort of galaxy brain, or you know, you can call it a lot of different things, and it's been described in a lot of different ways. But these are people who, the people I write about are sort of like great books pilled almost, you know, like they are just, they think they're sort of Roman heroes, right? Who are going to replicate these great moments in history and have a new founding era. And they're obsessive about this kind of thing. And different factions are attracted to different historical figures. And it's not all silly. Like, it's easy to laugh about it, right? But a lot of this stuff, I think that it stems from problems we have in our culture, right? Failures that liberalism does have some failures. It is a complicated thing. And so a lot of what they say sounds ridiculous, and we can talk about how this happened to them, but a lot of it's sort of serious, or at least their diagnostics are interesting and useful, right? They're seeing real problems. They're responding to problems they're seeing around them. And so half of it's sort of crazy, silly online stuff, or like ivory tower stuff, or just like a problem of insularity. But I think a lot of it is a lot more serious than people are willing to recognize.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
I mean, I've had this suspicion for a while, because it is very easy, and it has been throughout the Trump years, to say, well, they're doing it all for the tax cuts, because they all like tax cuts. And certainly a lot of Republican politicians do like that, as well as their donors and some of the people that they represent. And then it's, well, they're doing it because they want to just stay in office, or they want to keep their jobs, or they want to have more power. They just like Trump. They're trying to defend Trump. They're too afraid not to defend Trump. And again, like you said, motivations are complex. And I think for a lot of different Republican politicians, those are in fact the motivations. But there are clearly people who have been radicalized. We know that people are radicalized. And some of those people who have been radicalized are currently at the upper echelons of our government, which brings us to J.D. Vance. And I've always thought about my suspicion about him, because everyone's like, you know, a lot of people are like, J.D. Vance is full of shit. He used to be this never Trumper. And, you know, now he's just doing it because he wants to get ahead. But I sense from J.D. Vance's interviews, his comments, that maybe he has been radicalized. Maybe he wasn't always like this, but he has been radicalized. And I wonder what you think about that. And if you could just talk about some of the ways that Vance is connected to the new right, both through some of the people he's close to and then some of the ideas that he espouses.
Sure. That's my impression, too, is that he's been radicalized, and maybe he has always been very open to this kind of thinking. But my sense is that around the time when his book came out, The Hillbilly Elegy, sort of other books were coming out, or some of these people were rising in prominence on the new, what we're calling the new right, which for audience members is just sort of the intellectual wing of Trumpism, and we won't go into all the history of why it's old and new, right? But presumably he started seeing these writers, seeing these books like Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed in 2018. I think he probably was attracted to a lot of that. Maybe he studied some of this when he was in law school and stuff too, right? And sort of was always a little bit radicalized. And he knew Peter Thiel from early on, right? Or from around when his book came out. And so he's been close with some of the people on the new right from 2016 on. But he didn't support Trump originally, and then he eventually came around. And so I think that while this sort of new right movement was emerging and developing, he was presumably also becoming persuaded by some of these arguments. And he talks about by 2019, there's a speech where he talks about being converted to Trumpism. And so I think that's also the time when he converted to Catholicism. And one faction of the new right is sort of this Catholic faction, the post-liberals, that he seems to be the closest to. So we could go through sort of all of the different I could say a little bit about some of the different groups and his connections to those.
Yeah.
If that would be useful. I think that for Vance, the group he's closest to is this group called the post-liberals. Sometimes people speak about them as interchangeable with the integralists, neo-integralist movement, which is a very radical group of Catholics. I don't know that Vance sees himself as an integralist, but he does identify with the new right generally and with post-liberalism, which is sort of this elite, most serious group, I'd say, of the new right, because they're the most intellectually serious.
And what do they believe? What's the post-liberals?
The post-liberals sort of, they're really wanting to go to a, pre-liberal in the old-fashioned way, like almost medieval. They oppose the Catholic compromise with liberal democracy in France, is where some of the origins of this stuff comes from. And so they want a reintegration of church and state. Okay, if we're thinking about integralism, they think that all of government should be organized towards spiritual ends ultimately. And so the separation of church and state is something that they opposed. I mean, the true integralists are theocrats, but a lot of it's much more kind of cagey and sophisticated in its rhetoric. And so the people that Vance explicitly identifies with, like Patrick Deneen, who is quite close with some of these integralists, and Vance is close to people that are definitely flirting with some of these ideas of the kind of ultimate integration of church and state. And so just in practical terms, that turns into the anti-abortion stuff. I think they would take issue with, they would like want to make divorce much more difficult.
As J.D. Vance has talked about.
Yeah. And so some of those policies you can kind of, and I think overall they want a society where religion plays a much more prominent role in public life. And it's not clear that minority religions would have the same rights as other people. And I think if you get very extreme on some of this stuff, you have a situation where people who have been baptized in the Christian church, any Christian church, are subject to different laws, and so that which would be more extreme. So, I mean, it gets pretty radical, right? It gets
from theocracy adjacent to full-on theocracy, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to, you know, maybe people would still have rights who aren't Christian, and so that it's, I mean, they are not necessarily cruel, horrible people,
right.
but you get there pretty quickly. So that's sort of the way of thinking of some of those guys, and those are the ones that Vance is closest to, but they're also sort of politically a little on their own and not necessarily in the thick of the new right in the same way that some of these other groups are, and Vance is close with all of them. I mean, you kind of go from top to bottom, the most sophisticated, all the way down to some of the people who are sort of on the hard right, online, really nasty stuff. And Vance sort of peers in all of these different quadrants.
I was going to ask about, you, because you wrote about Vance's focus on gender ideology.
Yeah.
And if you could talk a little bit about gender ideology and some of Vance's views on gender beyond just his war against childless cat ladies. Which is, again, one of those things that, like, seems offensive, and then you can mock it, but it feels like there is something underlying those comments that is quite radical.
I mean, so gender ideology is used on the new right mainly to talk about sort of trans issues, right? And this and ideas about marriage and sexual relations and everything. So it's kind of a catch-all. I wrote about the anti-feminism, and there's a very, very strong streak of that in throughout the new right. I mean, the cat lady's comments, we can't just skip over it because that one really struck me because it's to me, it indicates that Vance is very closely, if not allied with, but very sort of immersed in some of the ugliest stuff on the new right, which is really anti-women, sort of in a way that they really do want to have a much more patriarchal system. So it's really, really radical. And some of the people writing this way, the cat ladies comment, I mean, they talk about how our regime is just dominated by, if not women, right, all these career women and the cat ladies, then female sort of values. They talk about it as if the whole country is just controlled by these sort of feminazis or right. That would be sort of the older lingo. That cat lady comment just really resonated with some of these. It just, to me, screamed that he was connected with sort of some of the worst characters or sympathetic to some of the ugliest misogyny on the new right. But I think in a more general way, and when we think about his sort of overall view and what he would ideally have, it is sort of more of this pronatalist family values version of it, but that is it would be a highly patriarchal version of it, where families that are traditional families would be the ones getting the benefits. Gay people would be excluded. And so you can think about Viktor Orban's Hungary and some of what's going on there. I think that he's very much eager to have something like that in the United States.
Yeah, well, when he made the comment, he specifically cited Kamala Harris, AOC, and Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah.
And it seems like the idea is people without children, either because they can't conceive or don't want to or whatever, or they should not be in charge. And there's too many of them in charge. And somehow the people who should be in charge and should get these benefits are people who are in traditional families where the woman has as many children as possible or should be encouraged to have as many children as possible, and that there's some value to people in this traditional family structure with children to the country and to governing that single people or gay people or people without children just don't have. Is that...
Yeah, I think that's right. You're maybe just missing the part where they feel so aggrieved, right? Where they feel like the traditional family not only isn't possible, it is not encouraged, it's hated on, right? And so that's, I think, motivating some of this sense that they need to compensate for all the hate they're getting, which I think is not right and is delusional. And it's actually not that hard to have a heterosexual family with kids in this country. I mean, there are real problems that they are concerned about, right? That it is really hard to have kids, right? It's really hard for everybody to raise kids in this country. There maybe aren't the supports that we need. And so to his credit, he wants to help assist people to have families. And I think that part of it is serious and real. But the sharper side of it is that it can only be the traditional family that he supports and that these policies will support. And I think that if, say, they were to be elected, you will see the true colors, right? I mean, are they going to compromise with liberals to make a family tax credit, right? I think that if it's going to be open to gay people or single people, they won't care about it enough. They care more about supporting traditional families than they do about helping everybody, is sort of what I would suspect. So I think that there's sort of these clashing motivations, but they're really angry about new forms of family, right? They're angry about these changes that have taken place. And I think that they do care about the family in a way that's sincere, right? And they truly believe that the traditional family is sort of the cornerstone of a thriving society. But there's no reason. I mean, I get so frustrated because there's no reason you can't support families and be pluralistic about it and be open to different styles of family and still pass some of these policies.
Well, what's their argument for why the traditional family needs to be the cornerstone of society that's not just, you know, openly bigoted? Like, what is their sort of intellectual reasoning behind this obsession with the traditional family structure?
Well, I think that you and I would agree that it is bigoted, that it is sort of a bigoted perspective. And I think that they get their backs up because they say, no, I have a different religious view, right? I don't believe that gay marriage is legitimate because they think homosexuality is a sin, right? And so it comes down to some really clashing deep values that they hold and that I don't hold. And so, I think that where they proceed to say, and the fact that we have these new forms of family, these new forms of marriage, the fact that that exists in our culture prevents them from preserving their way of life. And they're probably right about that. I think we should probably, as liberals, be honest that, right, it's harder for conservative Christians who believe it's a sin to preserve that belief with their kids and in their schools and stuff when there's all of these different pluralistic views around them and on television, and the culture is liberal. And I'm grateful for that, and I think it's fucking great, right? But they don't. And so I think—
They feel it slipping away, and they feel their control slipping away.
And they feel their control slipping away. And I think we have to be honest that it kind of is, right? And that's part of what's going on here, is that they are reacting to something real, and there's a really hard disagreement there that is— It sort of helps us understand why they're sort of in this world historical uproar, right? Because they really think that this is the devil in some cases, right? And sometimes some of these guys on the New Right talk that way. I mean, it's kind of esoteric, but they talk about demons and Satan. And so, I mean, so that's just what we're talking about. It is kind of a medieval clash. It's like the reason liberalism was invented was to manage these kinds of disagreements. And they reject it. They think it's gone too far, and that they are going to try to put a stop to it. And so I think we have to find a way. I mean, there's not an easy solution here. It's very hardcore disagreements.
Well, the other thing I've been thinking about is their views on democracy, right? And it does seem, and I think you brought this up earlier, but it does seem like a number of them now believe that democracy as it exists is no longer the best system of government, and that not everyone should have an equal voice, and that maybe we'd be better off if just a few people are in charge who are, I don't know, the smartest, the great men, the techno geniuses, right? Like, I feel like this sort of spans from like the Peter Thiel view of the world to some of these like right-wing social Christian conservatives. But how have their views on democracy evolved in the New Right?
Well, I think we're kind of talking about a faction of the New Right that, to the extent that it's been a continuous presence, which it kind of ebbs and flows, right? But I don't think they ever really cared that much about democracy, right? I mean, these are people, you think about Barry Goldwater was kind of some of this. And, you know, he's a complicated figure, but, you know, sort of against civil rights, right? This is kind of what we're talking about. These are not people who ever cared much about democracy, or this kind of streak of conservatism, I don't think does care much about democracy. But you're right, that's what we're talking about, right? Is these figures who are now very centrally important in the GOP, if not kind of in control of it. I mean, it's tricky because Trump doesn't necessarily play with people very well, right? And so they're kind of trying to maneuver this thing, but democracy is very low, I think, on their list of values. Some of them. I mean, it's not a priority for them. I think they're deeply hierarchical. They will play along with a bit of democracy. And it's also, I think some of them are practical enough to realize that Americans care about democracy. So they can't just completely they can't just spew off all their hierarchical medieval stuff openly. But I don't think they care deeply about it. I think they feel so aggrieved that they also feel like the only way that they can keep the power is to work with the counter-majoritarian features of our system, right? So nobody on the new right is talking about expanding voting rights or anything. They don't care deeply about that. They don't think people matter equally.
And just getting power to them and sort of instilling their vision and their agenda on the country is more important than risking that vision not being put into power because you gave too many people the right to say otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that they think it's at a point where, I mean, you use the tools you have available, and if that happens to be a voting booth, then good. But you use it, you get the power, you change things. I mean, from the philosophical perspective, the people that they're reaching back to are often, you know, you think about someone like Carl Schmitt from Germany, this very radical Nazi jurist who was very influential and talks all about sort of the friends and enemies distinction. And for him, everything is kind of an all or nothing existential combat, basically, right? And that's how a lot of these guys are thinking, right? They're like, okay, all that matters is getting the power for our side so that we can, like you said, impose our worldview as broadly as possible. And I think that might mean that the national level, if they can, they'll do what they can, and they've got a whole bunch of different ways of thinking about this. But it could just be at the state level, and I think we've seen a lot of that already being obviously worked out at the state level, and that's going to be here, I think, either way, you know, no matter who wins in November.
You mentioned Trump, and I'm sort of fascinated with how he fits into all of this, right? Because he's now been asked a couple times to respond to some of J.D. Vance's comments, the childless cat lady stuff, and he's got this very typical Trump sort of like rambling answer. But you can see, you know, Donald Trump, the guy who's been divorced three times and is probably, you know, has been pro-choice for most of his life, right, is sitting there and he's like, you know, all families are good, and some families are bad, and some families and some they stay together and some don't, and that's okay. And you can tell he's trying to, like, you know, walk it back a little bit. But there's been a lot of talk about Project 2025 in this election, and now he's named J.D. Vance as his running mate. And I think the optimistic case, the most optimistic case for Trump winning is, I've heard some people say, okay, Trump wins, he's just doing it because, you know, it's an ego thing. He wants to prove that he can win, and then he's going to do 4 years, and that's going to be it. And, you know, Trump can't get anything done anyway because he's kind of an idiot and whatever else. But it feels like, even if that is true, J.D. Vance is your vice president, and all the people behind Project 2025 seem to be some of these people and have some of these ideas that are much more radical that you've been writing about. Is that true? Or how do you think
that
would work?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think J.D. Vance is very much, he's closely connected to a lot of that, the people in the Project 2025 stuff. And as I was writing that piece for Politico, I did come across this this line from Vance from an interview in 2021 where he's spouting this very radical stuff. Can I just read this quickly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this is like, this didn't make it into the piece, I don't think. But he's talking about what he thinks Trump should do if he were to win in 2024. And it's very radical. It might as well have come right from the preface of Kevin Roberts. He wrote the introduction to the Project 2025. Mm. And so it might as well have come from this, and it sounds a lot like some of the Catholic integralist stuff. So let me just read this. Okay, he says, "I tend to think that we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left. We need like a de-bathification program, a de-wokeification program. I think Trump is going to run again in 2024. I think that what Trump should do, if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, and replace them with our people." So Vance was saying that in 2021. That's before there was a Project 2025, right?
Yeah.
And so he's definitely sort of in it with all that. In terms of how this plays out with Trump himself, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And I think that Trump made that decision to have Vance be his running mate. I mean, I was shocked by that decision, I'll tell you. I think it was a really ballsy decision and a really sort of super masculinist decision, just like risky, bold, and pretty foolish. And I think that it was cocky. And it was a move that was probably to please Elon Musk and Thiel, or I'm not sure what. And this sort of new, but it was definitely like a stamp of approval to the new right when he chose Vance.
Yeah.
And so I think it backfired very quickly because of Kamala. And I don't think they obviously didn't expect Biden to get out, right? And yeah. So it's kind of been amazing, right, these past few weeks to see that unfold, because I think it's shown, I mean, this stuff is not especially popular necessarily, right, with mainstream people, with normal people. Trump has his charms, right? We can kind of, I mean, it was so weird at first, but I think now we can all kind of understand a little bit more about what's going on with that guy. And it is a cult of personality, and he's very funny. And he's a weird guy, but he is what he is. And he's totally unpredictable. And I don't think he's an ideologue in the way that these guys are. I mean, obviously, right?
Right.
He's not reading this shit. He's not concerned about Catholicism. So he is their tool, right? And they think they can maneuver him. And it's not at all clear how much he'll go along with, especially now that he sees how unpopular some of it is. But you know, you just don't know either, because I don't see him. I think a lot of this stuff with the Project 2025 and Vance, it's very strategic. He's just going to say what he thinks people want to hear.
Yep.
And then once he's in power, they'll do whatever they want, right? To the extent that they can get it together. And I think that's the real worry, is that now with Project 2025, with all of the establishment, the old establishment is now these think tanks and stuff, like they are behind him now. And they weren't before. They weren't in 2016. You didn't even have Heritage. They were supporting him and they helped him staff his administration, but it wasn't like it is now. This is really a different thing. So he can say he doesn't like 2025, and but he's not going to disavow all of these people and all of this work that's been done. So there's no sign that he won't do it. I don't think, but it's anybody's guess. I think what he actually is capable of doing, or what he would want to do, and especially if it's so unpopular.
Yeah, my gut on this is that he's just not gonna. He's not an attention to details guy. And he's going to be busy with whatever fights he's picking every day and whatever TV show he's watching. But he will have people in the government who have tremendous power who can implement a lot of this. I do think that my first reaction to the J.D. Vance pick was it's a pick that came from overconfidence, cockiness. We're going to beat Joe Biden. We've got this election wrapped up. Let's just shoot the moon here. But now that Kamala Harris is the nominee, it does feel to me like this is it's not just their worst nightmare in terms of now they think they're going to lose, but there is a biracial woman who could win the presidency. And having been on both Obama campaigns in 8 and you know, Palin started, Sarah Palin was sort of an early warning sign of this when we were running against McCain.
Yeah.
Having been, you know, helping elect the first black man to be president, things have gotten so much more extreme on the right in the ensuing years that I sort of wonder how the new right's reaction will manifest itself over the course of this election. Like this, it feels like this is their nightmare, and they will throw everything they have at trying to stop Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's hard to see how they could get much more radical. I think you're right. And they can't help themselves a lot of the time, I think. So, I mean, when you say their worst nightmare, I think you're right. She's their worst nightmare. She's probably worse than Hillary, though they might not have the kind of instinctive animus that they did for her. But I also think it's their worst nightmare in terms of the people in the new right who are smart probably understand that this is really a big challenge and a liability, and that the stuff is so racist and so misogynist, the whole movement kind of is, that it's going to be hard to rein that in. Mm. And they probably need to if they want to win.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's really complicated, but they're gonna just ramp it up probably because that's who they are.
Yeah.
And they are genuinely freaked out about the progressive America that we have, or we're starting to have, right?
Yeah.
And so the funny thing about Kamala is she's not miserable. She's a very happy person. She's not a miserable cat lady. So
which they also hate, yeah.
They hate it, and they cannot sort of wrap their heads around women having power.
Yeah.
So it's very tricky for them. I think they're in a real bind.
Last question on this. From the Harris campaign's perspective, they're going to have to deal with all of this and handle all of this. Do you have thoughts on how they do that without sort of giving the new right what they want?
Right, because without going off on identity politics and sort of,
Exactly. Because I've been thinking about that a lot because they are clearly... Yeah. Either strategically or just because that's who they are, baiting the Harris campaign as they did with Hillary, as they did with Obama, to like get in this fight with them about identity and race and gender.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you said earlier, they are part of this movement is like recognizing real problems that exist in America. And you want to, I imagine that if you're the Harris campaign or any campaign opposing them, you want to acknowledge the problems that we have in this country, acknowledge the struggles families are having in this country without sort of tripping some of the wires that would sort of ignite people that might be find the new right appealing.
Yeah, I think avoiding some of the most woke talk would be rhetorically strategic, right? But not because you want to please the new right, but I think that they want to be thinking about ordinary Americans. And ordinary Americans are not radicalized, I don't think. I think I've seen some evidence. I don't think they're radicalized to this extent. I don't think they love this crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Surely some people love parts of it, right? Some of it. But I think that if they can focus on that, just like you said, the real problems that exist, and also I think they should be outspoken about the fact that most Americans aren't radicalized in this way. I think the stuff about the weirdness of the new right is good.
Yeah.
It is weird, and it is it's not, I don't think it is that popular once people start to understand what's going on here.
Mm.
And I think that they also need to have a positive liberal vision, right? And they need to kind of bang on that stuff, right? That we are a pluralistic society, and we can also come together as Americans. I mean, all that sort of old. Obama was very good at this.
Well, as I was gonna say, it's got to be rooted in it's a war over the definition of patriotism and what it is to be American. And there's always been two definitions. There's the definition that the right is now reaching back for, right, which is this hierarchical, you know, white male only, you know, society, landowning society. But then there's the other vision, which is, this is a country, this is the world's biggest experiment in multi-ethnic, multi-racial democracy that includes everyone and gives everyone a voice. And that's been part of our founding too, even if we haven't always lived up to it.
And that those are the values that unite us, right? I mean, that you can actually have a positive belief in multiculturalism and think that that's a really valuable thing that you can learn from, and you can, you know, I think that they need to keep that in mind, that those are real things that we can hold on to, that I think Americans believe in, and that these guys really don't. And so I think pointing to the radicalism I don't think you need to be super, I'm pro-woke, right? But I think that some of that lingo and some of the, you know, box checking has always been a real problem for Democrats, right? The kind of identity, like, okay, we've got this person, that person. Mm. That's been a real problem because it's alienating, because it isn't unifying, right? And it just on a sort of commonsensical approach, you can't, that's just not going to be, that's necessarily going to be alienating to anybody who's not on those lists, right?
Yeah.
Of identities.
Trying to build a majority.
Laura
Field, thank you so much for chatting with me and for making us so much smarter on the philosophical and intellectual roots of all this craziness that we're seeing on the right. So I appreciate that.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
The Supreme Court might be on break, but the conservative agenda is still going full steam ahead. Project 2025 is a 900-page far-right wish list that lays out a hyper-specific and bone-chillingly fascist roadmap for a second Trump administration. Over at Strict Scrutiny, our favorite trio of badass constitutional law professors is breaking down the full 900 pages in a four-part series with your Monday episodes. Melissa, Leah, and Kate scoured all the fine print for you because lawyers are sick freaks who love that shit. Stay informed about the far-right agenda and its real-life implications for tens of millions of Americans as we head into this election cycle by listening to Strict Scrutiny wherever you podcast or on YouTube. The election is a little under 100 days away, and now is the time to volunteer, donate, and canvass your ass off for progressive candidates and initiatives up and down the ballot. Sign up for a shift at VoteSaveAmerica.com and pick up a canvassing kit for yourself or maybe for a friend in a swing state. It has all the essentials for a day of door knocking, including a clipboard, pen, band-aids, a tote bag, and more. The Crooked Store gives back with every order to support organizations doing incredible work across the U.S. to make sure every voice can be heard. Head to crooked.com/store to get your kit now. Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau, along with Max Fisher. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Emma Illick-Frank is our associate producer, mixed and edited by Jordan Cantor, audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, and Reed Cherlin for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Delon Villanueva, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.